I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. While the winner of the 2016 presidential election has been decided, there are still questions about the role and influence that Russian bots and trolls played in influencing public opinion. Russian operatives apparently bought misleading and inflammatory ads on Facebook and Twitter that targeted specific groups and locations in key states, including Pennsylvania. Google's news algorithms were used to spread false stories during the election and more recently to misidentify the Las Vegas shooter. These social media sites designed for the neutral distribution of information are increasingly how people around the world are getting their news, which is why this is such an important issue. We're going to talk about how Russians were able to use this technology against us and what can be done to protect the public from hoaxes and pranks and propaganda and fabrications and conspiracy theories. We have two guests who have joined us. Alexis Madrigal is staff writer for The Atlantic. Alexis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is April Glazer, and she's technology writer for Slate, and she's joining us by Skype. April, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks.
Let me begin with you, Alex. What did these ads look like? Do we know?
Well, we know that they weren't just political ads. They didn't just say, vote for Donald Trump, don't vote for Hillary Clinton, or vice versa. We know that they, according to Senator Mark Warner, who's seen the ads, been handed over to him, that they targeted certain divisive issues in American culture and seemed to press on them. We haven't seen, obviously, the full set of 3,000 ads that have been discovered. We don't know what percentage of the total ads that was. And I think, more importantly, the ads are like a small subset of the overall campaign that was being run. And I think most indications are that the reach of this disinformation was greater sort of in what we would call in the media organic sense, right, just people posting to these Facebook pages than the ads. But the ads are sort of the radioactive tracer that has drawn congressional attention and public scrutiny.
April, what do you think these ads were designed to do? Turn us against each other or what?
Not necessarily turn us against each other, but definitely kind of stoke unrest, right? So some of the ads were, pro-gun. Some of the ads were against the Black Lives Matter movement, saying that it was kind of a divisive political movement. Some were for the Black Lives Matter movement. Some said that Muslim women supported Hillary Clinton. And so, in some ways to turn us against each other, but definitely to provoke kind of some of the most divisive parts of the American political landscape.
And do you think, April, and to you, Alexis, do you think it represents a sophisticated understanding of our electoral system, or are we much more obvious than that? April?
Yeah, somewhat sophisticated understanding of our electoral system, but definitely a sophisticated understanding of what, angers Americans and where Americans disagree. And to be clear, it wasn't just political issues that these ads touched on. There was, a Facebook group and some ads that, or maybe not ads, but a Facebook group and some promotional work around like puppies, for instance, And so they were certainly trying to get Americans' attention.
Well, puppies always work. Alexis, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it definitely shows a sophisticated understanding of how our digital media landscape works. That's for sure. I mean, this seems to me like a content operation, not unlike you'd see if somebody was trying to start up a Facebook page about anything and turn it into something that had real distribution power. So in the dog example, I mean, what's really interesting about that is you grow the page with puppies, and then at some later point, you switch it over to the kind of divisive political issue that they're pushing with. So I think when you look at the ads, the pages, because we don't know how targeted these were to specific regions that would show the kind of political savvy that we might expect. But we can say that at the very least, they're as good as a digital content shop running in New York, running ads or a campaign for a big business.
And picking up on that to you, Alexis, I mean, it sounds as if whoever these people were, they've been described as bots and trolls, essentially using the technology of Facebook or Twitter and how ads are distributed, and basically just using that to perhaps ill ends.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I think in the long sweep of history here, you've got the U.S. And Russian intelligence offices using whatever media are available to them to try and spread problems for the other side. You know, we know that even just within the U.S., you know, the CIA funded media operations, and I think this is just the latest iteration. I think it sounds particularly strange and weird because most people don't actually know how Facebook works.
Oh, really?
They don't know. I think that most people don't understand how the ads are targeted, the way that posts are pushed to people. You know, up until very recently, a lot of people didn't even know that Facebook was selecting the ranking of posts in your news feed, the kind of main column that where people find what's happening on Facebook. And so I think the real danger for Facebook is that this just leads people to look under the hood of Facebook. And I think when most people do that, it doesn't feel, I think the thing you said in the intro at the top, it doesn't feel like a neutral distribution platform. Of course, my contention would maybe be that there is no such thing as a neutral distribution.
Which we will definitely pick up on, and I get that. April, let me get you to weigh in on that from the Twitter perspective. So much of social media is about engagement. It's about, you know, things going viral. Can you speak to that?
Sure. So, you know, on Twitter, we saw a somewhat different style of kind of manipulation from, you know, the Russian, from Russian government linked groups. And we saw bots primarily. And, you know, it's interesting because these bots really show kind of a false groundswell of grassroots support. You know, for instance, we know that Donald Trump's Twitter following is, you know, at least 30% fake or bots or automated software accounts where there's not like a person sitting there pressing tweet every time, but rather a software program that someone wrote. And that really is problematic because when we see a tweet that has, you know, 50,000 retweets or something like that, it gives the impression that this is something that really matters, that people support it or that people are against it or they're concerned about it. And we found that a lot of that concern is actually fake. And in fact, you know, we have also learned that a number of the bots that that were very active during the election and, of course, after the election as well, like after Charlottesville, were from Russian-backed, you know, groups. And they would often take a picture from, you know, a model off of Instagram or you know, put a fake bio up and then tweet something like five times a minute, wow, which is just not something a person can do.
And we're in many ways dealing with algorithms and I guess bots and not persons, which I do want to get to. Let me play something that Mark Zuckerberg, of course, Facebook founder, CEO of Facebook, said yesterday. This was a taped statement in response to a lot of the criticism that's been leveled against Facebook and frankly against him.
Now, I wish I could tell you that we're going to be able to stop all interference, but that just wouldn't be realistic. There will always be bad actors in the world, and we can't prevent all governments from all interference. But we can make it harder. We can make it much harder. And that's what we're going to focus on doing.
Alexis, what can Facebook do about this?
Well, you know, in some ways, I think this is a labor problem. You know, they built a service that has reshaped and reformed the way that news and information moves, not just in the U.S., but in many, many countries in the world. And they haven't hired enough people to know what's happening all the time. I think you can't expect them to monitor absolutely everything, but it also shouldn't have taken them many months to figure out that there was Russian interference on their platform. Like, to me, that was the sign that they really didn't know what was going on, that they repeatedly said there were no Russian ads, there was no Russian interference. And then lo and behold, like many months later, they go, oops, actually, we were able to figure it out. And from the description that they've given, it wasn't like some informant revealed themselves. It was like they did some of the basic analysis that humans have done to see what these were Russian networks look like. So to me, that is kind of the core problem. And I'll just, last thing I'll say is they're deployed in countries where they don't really have anyone who speaks the language from that country. And I, to me, when I really think about that, it's a real abdication of responsibility, particularly in countries that may have less strong election norms, where people, you know, jumped straight into the mobile internet without intervening kind of stages, sort of get used to how information flows on the internet, and to basically have no one minding the store that they've built and are making money from strikes me as a huge problem. And I think, I don't know how you solve it aside from hiring a lot of people.
Alexis, let me pick up on something that you wrote. You said that the world's largest distributor of information is Facebook's news feed. So is Facebook now a news company like the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Atlantic?
Right. I mean, they took over news distribution. I mean, this is kind of a key disagreement that I've had with people both in the company as well as people who used to work for them. I mean, they took over news distribution. Like, if you owned all of the broadcasting equipment across the country, like, would you be in the news business if you broadcast news? Yes, of course you would. And I think that comes with certain responsibilities that they continue to refuse to take on. And I get it. The news business, as we all know, has been in decline. You don't make a ton of money, and their current profit margins are like 50%. So they're in a much better business, but I think they sort of broke it, so they bought it. That's the way I see it.
How do you see it, April? About a minute or so before our break.
Sure. And, you know, just to build on something that Alexa said, you know, Facebook says it has about 2 billion monthly active users. And one of its fixes for this kind of, you know, Russian influence problem for the U.S. election has been to bring on 1,000 more people. That scale is just does not fit. And it is a real labor problem. Another thing that I'll add is that, you know, Facebook's kind of official policy has been that they are not responsible for what others post on their platform. And that has to do with a law from the 90s that that they really want to continue to have in their court that says that they're not liable for what people post. And because of that, they've kind of turned away and looked away from having any sort of responsibility for what types of things propagate.
I want to pick up on all of that. That's April Glazer. She's technology writer for Slate. Also with us is Alexis Madrigal, and she is staff writer for The Atlantic. We are talking about Facebook and Twitter. We'll be talking about Google as well, how people get their news, but also how they get misinformation and hoaxes and propaganda through some of these particular social media sites. And you can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the role that Twitter and Facebook have played and are playing, also how Google is playing, how Americans and people around the world get their information and, frankly, misinformation, what they should and shouldn't do to protect the public from fabrications, from pranks, hoaxes, conspiracy theories, and propaganda. And again, our guests are April Glazer of Slate and Alexis Madrigal of The Atlantic. Let me play something that Democratic Senator Mark Warner said last week, vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, discussing the Twitter team's testimony.
The presentation that the Twitter team made to the Senate Intel staff today was deeply disappointing. The notion that their work was basically derivative based upon accounts that Facebook had identified showed an enormous lack of understanding from the Twitter team of how serious this issue is, the threat it poses to democratic institutions, and again, begs many more questions than they offered. their response was, frankly, inadequate.
And April, I want to get a response from you. I should say that I believe it's November 1st. The representatives from Twitter, Facebook, and Google have been asked to appear before, I believe, this particular committee, maybe even a House committee as well. Does Twitter not get it, according from at least certainly that's what Senator Warner thinks?
Well, they certainly didn't show as much as they could have, right? I mean, they showed 201 accounts, like you said, that were related to the accounts that Facebook already shared. But we already have a dashboard that monitors 600 accounts that are linked to the Kremlin in some way from the Alliance for Securing Democracy that shows kind of what these Twitter accounts are showing. So if academics and nonprofits have indicated 600 as just a small sampling of these accounts and Twitter just handed over 200, then Warner is indicating correctly that they're not really showing all their cards here, and they probably will have to come November 1st. Twitter, you know, would argue that they were just showing what they can do and what they can show, right. but do expect to see more.
But what is the reluctance about, April?
You know, I think the reluctance is about admitting some sort of responsibility. You know, if they are able to show that there are just thousands and thousands and thousands of accounts that are, you know, somehow manipulating the election, or not the election, but the electorate, by showing, like I said, a false sense of support for candidates or for issues, then how could Twitter not know about this? And why didn't Twitter do something about it? And the thing is that, you know, any person who follows these issues or will be able to say, you know, or can say rather, that Twitter can do something about it. And it's not that difficult to find these. It just hasn't.
Alexis, you said Facebook needs to hire more people. You both have actually said that. Is that the most dramatic solution, which is to have human beings making some analysis about whether an ad is fake or not?
Yes, I think so. You know, Facebook has said that one of the things that was difficult for them was that what the pages were posting sort of looked like normal political speech or normal speech on Facebook. And so their machine learning algorithms and their artificial intelligence that's supposed to flag things like this just couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we just forget, like, as these companies are moving through time, they're encountering a lot of these problems for the first time, or they're encountering new variants of those problems. And what machine learning and artificial intelligence is really good at is taking data that where there's a lot of labeled information, where you can say this situation is very similar to all these other situations. And what we're dealing with here is something that's totally different, where, you know, kind of each problem that comes up is novel, and humans are good at dealing with that. Hmm. I think the pushback that you get from these companies and their supporters is that, well, you know, do you want Mark Zuckerberg controlling, like, news for the world? And my response to that has been, well, look, we have journalistic norms for a reason. We have, like, news practices that, as sort of a guild of people, we've agreed to. And in any reasonable system, it wouldn't be Mark Zuckerberg, you know, like, yaying and naying individual posts. Like, that's not what people are suggesting. And I think that's kind of one of the big red herrings that gets thrown up.
Is there also a question, April, about the gullibility of the public? I mean, one of the more, I would say, egregious ads having to do, or I guess it wasn't an ad so much, but as a news story that people believed, or certainly a man believed, that Hillary Clinton was running a child sex ring out of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. A guy actually went there with a gun to deal with what he apparently believed. But is there a gullibility problem?
There is, and there's a media literacy problem, and that's because the media landscape is just changing so quickly, and it's being manipulated in ways that was just really hard to foresee. But, you know, and it's not just these ads, like you just mentioned. It is stories that circulate. You know, for example, one of the ways that that Russian linked groups would propagate false information was just by simply posting posts on Facebook for free, and then boosting those posts, right? And since they didn't pay for for that those posts to appear on the platform, but rather just paid for them to go further, they're not technically considered ads. And so we are seeing all kinds of ways that misinformation is being propagated. And also, if you look at the construction of the way a news story looks on Facebook, you know, it's difficult to kind of see exactly where it's from. It's in very small lettering at the bottom where the website is, and people often don't even click on it.
Sure. Is it just Russia? Do we know, April?
I'm sure it's not just Russia. All kinds of political groups in the United States boost posts that they put out. And honestly, I would be surprised if the United States isn't doing something similar that what Russia did in the U.S. to other elections around the world.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I've often wondered about that. I don't know, obviously, what the answer is. Alexis, have you thought about that as well?
Just the U.S. side or the disinformation?
Well, both. Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah. If Russians do, I mean, we've certainly meddled in elections in the past before there was the internet.
I don't know that we have like smoking guns in most cases, but I mean, we know that we even set up like we funded and set up a social network in Cuba, for example, like a whole social network, not just like individual posts like within it, but like a whole thing. And I feel like if we know that much. We're certainly monitoring all over the world, and I would be surprised if there wasn't some action. I think, you know, these are American companies, though. They've more thoroughly penetrated the way that information moves within the U.S. almost than anywhere else. And I think at the same time, you have the legacy problems of media, like which, you know, sort of came from, you know, the breakdown of the mainstream media into sort of more partisan coalitions of sites and broadcasters. And so I think when you take those dynamics, you know, which had been fostered by, you know, right-wing radio and a bunch of other historical factors, and you sort of push that through this new media ecosystem, you start to get a lot of really weird stuff, because people are so willing to believe terrible things about some figures. And one thing we do know also about, you know, fake news in the sense of literal hoaxes, is that familiarity with those stories makes people more likely to believe them. So the more misinformation that goes into the system, the more people are likely to believe that kind of misinformation. To me, that's why this problem has become so urgent, because it's going to get worse if we don't start to move quickly.
I mean, we do have the Weekly World News, right? I mean, I don't know how I don't know what their readership is, but that does exist in the media landscape, to put it in a cliche way.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, what if those were tucked inside the New York Times and the Washington Post, and in exactly the same typefaces and fonts? I mean, this is actually what we're dealing with. It's not just that there are, you know, active government efforts in Russia and elsewhere to influence things. There's also all the hucksters and just people who want to make money off this stuff that they can exploit. So these information networks that are spreading hoaxes and misinformation aren't just motivated politically. There's also these people who just make a quick buck by spreading stories that the Pope endorsed Donald Trump in the presidency.
And that is Alexis Madrigal, staff writer for The Atlantic. Also with us, April Glazer, technology writer for Slate. And you can join our conversation. We're curious about where you get your news. We're talking about Facebook and Twitter. We'll be talking about Google as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A very self-serving tweet here. I get my news from all of the above, but I trust NPR the most. April, what about Google? How do you see Google as part of this conversation?
They're, you know, deeply a part of this conversation. Whenever you want to know anything in the world these days, you're pretty much, the first step is to Google it, right? Mm-hmm. And that includes news. And And, you know, we know that the Google has not done the best job of necessarily curating the most credible sources to the top of what, you know, people find when they go to Google, whether it's their top stories box on their search page or even their news section, which I do believe that they try very hard to curate and get the best information out there. And it's not just Google as a search engine, but it's also YouTube, right? We know that Russia Today, for example, which is one of the Russian government linked news sites that the U.S. government and the CIA in an intelligence report rather said was a huge problem leading up to the election, is one of the top one of the top news sites on YouTube, right? And so we really have to ask how they're weighing the sources that they decide to bring to the top and prioritize when people are looking for information.
And April, I mean, I'm assuming this is all continuing today, all the things we've been talking about this morning.
All continuing today in that if
and then we still got, you know, propaganda and hoaxes and lies and fabrications, all of that getting posted on Facebook, Twitter and part of Google.
You know, Facebook, Twitter, Google, they're all working quite hard, I think, right now, or at least are appear to be trying to stop this. They seem to shut down pages when they're pointed out, you know, and that makes it kind of hard to investigate sometimes because we hear about a page and we can't go back because they shut it down. And that's probably a good thing that they stopped it from running and spreading bad information. But it does seem like they're just kind of chasing this problem more than they are actually putting in solutions that would stop it before it goes further. One thing, for instance, that Facebook did was allow in the issue of fake news was they actually put the onus on the users to flag a fake news post as disputed, as opposed to, say, doing the work themselves and maybe stopping the fake news post from being prioritized to someone's feed in the first place.
Alexis, do we know what Congress wants to do? There is this hearing in a couple of weeks.
Well, you know, I think there's sort of three options here. I mean, one is they could, you know, kind of nibble around the edges, maybe pass some things, like some small things, and, you know, just kind of a grandstand beating up on these technology executives. I that's definitely going to happen. You know, the next step up would be something like, you know, going really deep into the consumer protection law. So, you know, the things that were used to, you know, put railings on staircases and seatbelts in cars and say, look, this is a danger to American consumers. And therefore, we're going to, like, put new regulations and new guardrails and seatbelts on a sort of informational system. Or, you know, there's to me, it feels like there has been quite a sea change in the way that people are looking at technology companies. And you could reach further back for another historical analogy to when cities first sort of came together in major conglomerations in kind of late 19th century America. And what you end up with is all these people dying, them burning down, unclean water. And what was required to make cities livable was really like a true reform movement, progressive movement. And I could see something even that big that people start to say, hey, wait, look, these companies have some monopolistic tendencies. There have been these like sort of misinformation problems. Many other industries have been destroyed in their wake, and that maybe we need to do something big, really big. And that, you know, I don't know what the mechanisms for that would be. And I certainly don't think they would occur solely within the government, as with the previous progressive movement back then. But it wouldn't be shocking to me to start to see a lot of movement simultaneously across the different kind of problems that the tech industry is having.
Do you see that, April, the public, in a sense, rising up against this?
Well, the public is certainly starting to realize that it's a problem. But one issue with regulating these companies is kind of the same cycle that we see with campaign finance reform, right? Like, I don't think we're going to see meaningful laws around kind of data-driven targeting or the propagation of, you know, unverified information on these platforms because unless, like, candidates really stop depending on data-driven targeting and data-driven ads or, you know, data-driven posts in order to get elected. targeted, right? And so since candidates really use these platforms to target political ads to users, to constituents, and to send messages to constituents, and probably also use the data targeting that we saw instrumentalized by these Russian-linked groups, I think it's going to be a big uphill climb to see them regulated. That said, it's not like there have never been laws in the U.S. for companies that deliver and curate media to adhere to some sort of public interest law obligations. And I'm thinking here about kind of the history of broadcast election laws with like the Fairness Doctrine and making sure that candidates have equal time and stuff like that. The spirit of those laws were very much to make sure that democracy functions in the public interest.
But do you see changing the ad structure or infrastructure as it has been described? I mean, the way we see ads chasing us around when we're doing our social media?
Again, I think it's going to be difficult to change this ad ecosystem because candidates really use it a lot to get elected. And the FEC is probably not going to step in when it comes to regulating political ads on internet companies. They haven't taken meaningful action around internet political advertising or kind of internet, political content since 2006. And to put that in perspective, in 2006, Facebook, for a large part of that year, was still only available to students, right?
Oh, my gosh, really? Wow.
Yeah, this is when AOL Instant Messenger was
Time flies.
And so I think it's important to realize that the FEC is very much not the organization to work on this, and Congress is very invested in using these platforms themselves.
Alexis, we do have it's a midterm election, but we do have an election next year. Do you see Congress, even maybe the public, gearing up for some of this stuff?
That's an interesting question. Certainly, I think people will be more on guard about the things that are happening. I mean, I think one political note that I would make is that the congressman who's been leading a lot of these efforts, Mark Warner, represents a lot of technology companies in Virginia. I mean, Northern Virginia has a whole bunch of technology companies, but they're not the same ones that are sort of part of this inquiry. In fact, a lot of them do a lot of work with the government, are used to being regulated heavily in one way or another. And I think what you're kind of seeing is separating off a few of these really big, really powerful technology companies. It's worth noting, outside of Saudi Aramco, the five most valuable companies in the world are all headquartered in between San Francisco and Seattle. Wow. And that those are the companies that I think are most likely to have something happen.
Alexis, we have to say goodbye to you and to you, April, as well. And I thank you both so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Alexis Madrigal and April Glazer. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Glenn Thrush, White House correspondent for the New York Times, decided recently to get off Twitter, saying it had become too much of a distraction, the biggest time suck since asteroids, he told Pointer. New York Times columnist Brett Stevens called Twitter political pornography, revealing but distorting, exciting but dull, bad for the soul and bad for the country. By the way, he's keeping his Twitter handle. Well, we wanted to find out more about journalists' love-hate relationship with Twitter, and we asked Alexandra Petri to join us on Radio Times, and she is a columnist for The Washington Post. And Alexandra, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So what does Twitter mean to you?
Well, nothing that either of them said was wrong. It's definitely a fun asteroid filled with pornography.
Right.
Exactly. I think
something like that. Yes.
No, but I really do. I have Twitter open right now on my phone. it's, I think, a fun place to go and make puns and interact with other human minds across the World Wide Web, to use a vintage term. Somebody, I think, recently described Twitter as a place where people go to call women ugly and journalists go to praise each other. And I'm like, yeah, that's all right.
Sounds about right.
Twitter in a nutshell.
But do you think there really is this love-hate relationship, or just people say that they actually really love it?
Well, I think it's one of those things where everyone has their agonized story of how they came to New York or Los Angeles and left one or the other of them because of deep reasons. And Twitter is sort of the same. It's like it's a mental space that everyone has very strong feelings for why they're in it or not in it.
How many followers do you have?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I think somewhere fewer than the number of casualties at the Battle of Antietam.
Oh, really? But I forget what that is. Thousands, I'm assuming. Tens of thousands?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think like 90,000-ish.
Ish. And how do you think of your followers?
I think of them as people who have a very high tolerance for terrible puns.
Because mostly. That's what you're really good at?
Honestly, that's mostly what I put out on my feed. It'll be a combination of really just awful jokes about the names in the headlines twisted in ways that are completely unthinkable into horrible contorted Frankensteins of puns, or it'll just be my column, or it'll be me retweeting articles that I think were interesting, or it'll just be me checking it and checking it over and over again, hoping to find meaning or reason in all of it.
Do you pun in when you're not on Twitter? Is that part of your personality, your nature?
Well, yeah, I would say actually it's sort of a nice escape valve where, like in video games, you can go and like strangle zombies so that then you can go home and not, I assume, physically strangle the people around you.
Right.
I'm not sure if that's the consensus on how video games work. I know people have other theories about that as well. But in Twitter, it's enabled me to be a much more welcome at social gatherings because all the puns are in a tiny box in my hand instead of emerging from my mouth in the middle of the hors d'oeuvres.
I mean, we do have a president who tweets incessantly. We had a guest earlier in the hour said probably about 30% of his Twitter followers are not actually people, but bots and trolls and things like that. How much do you think that drives just the interest, the connection to Twitter that so many, especially journalists, have?
Well, I think bots can be some of your most loyal followers.
Apparently.
Because they're so consistent in their beliefs. And I have this one guy who tweets every day about Groundhog Day to me. And I don't know if it's like a joke about Groundhog Day or if his algorithm broke somewhere. But I like to think of it as a person who's trapped in a Groundhog Day scenario and is therefore tweeting this on a daily basis. And I think the funny thing about Twitter and sort of the personal curated echo chamber that you can create by following or unfollowing people is then if you have like an army of bots, you get to hang out with robots and think that they share your opinions. And that's a very exciting futuristic thing. Robots are lines of code.
Do you follow the president's tweets?
I read them. I don't follow him because my one unfollow is the real difference that's going to, matter to his ego. He's going to look at it and be like, there's one missing and that's just eating away at me. Actually, I don't know. But no, I do. I check every so often to see what rumblings he's put forth.
I've heard some journalists talk about an addiction, and I think that's a word that's, tossed around oftentimes without any particular meaning. But do you see that among your colleagues? An addiction?
Well,
as you said, you have Twitter in your hand as we're speaking, but do you see it as an addiction?
Well, I don't know. I think of all the things to be addicted to, people always talk about, you're addicted to the internet. Well, the internet is just a place where everyone's mind lives. It's where you get to go and be connected to people who are in different places than you, who share some very specific love. And you form these little sort of niche communities of the other, like, 10 people who really want to read, like, stories about ponies with tentacles. And, like, that's your community. So what the or something, hypothetical random example. But the so of all the things to be addicted to, like interaction with other human beings isn't, I think, the worst. So that's what I would sort of say on that.
I hear you. I hear you. Have you ever tweeted and wanted to take something back?
Sometimes if I didn't phrase it correctly, I'll make it sound like, oh, no, what it sounded like I was saying was that I hated all children, but what I meant to say was I didn't like the statue of the child facing down the bull. Then, I'll want to take something back.
Did you say that? I hate all children?
No.
Okay.
That was a hypothetical example. Or I'll say something and, I'll think, oh, man, somebody who read that, who actually sort of, knew the situation might feel hurt by that. Then, you have to sort of watch. And, the funny thing, I think I was reading this profile of Max Landis where he was saying that at first he was just like, oh, I'm a consumer of stuff. And then, once you get enough followers, suddenly the people who make it can read and see what you're saying. So, a friend of mine, loves Snap. Do you know, the one where, there's a oh no, there's been a very exciting murder and we're going to figure out why it happened, and was tweeting about like the voice of the woman who does the thing, and like the person liked the tweet. And so suddenly you realize, oh, the people who made this thing that I thought I could just joke about in a vacuum are actually out there and listening.
Fair enough. Alexandra Petrie, our guest in this portion of Radio Time. She's a columnist for The Washington Post. We are talking about Twitter. She has her Twitter in her hand as she is speaking to us, and we want to hear from you. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. How do you see Twitter, and how much do you tweet during the day? We want to hear from you. Let me get Pat. Pat calling us from Mays Landing in New Jersey. Hi, Pat. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yeah. First of all, I don't even understand why it's called social media, because it's about the most unsocial thing that I can think of.
Really?
What happened to... Well, yeah. I don't understand why people... Would sign up on Twitter or Facebook or any of those things. What happened to human contact?
Well, can't you have both? Pat, can't you have both?
Well, I don't know, but it's dangerous as far as I can see, and I want to talk to humans. I'm so tired of computers and everything. You know, when you call to have something going on with your electric bill, you have to talk to a computer, and
that's
terrible.
Well, Alexander, do you see this as something that excludes human interaction, human contact?
Well, I just wanted to say, I also hate when I call and have something wrong with my electric bill, and as a robot, and every single button that you push on the phone won't connect you to another person. I think times like that, you really do need to talk to a human. Then again, sometimes you can tweet to the electric company and say, hey, I've got a problem with my bill, and they'll actually get back to you. So I think, on the one hand, I love face-to-face interaction, but there's some kinds of things that you wouldn't be able to find anyone in your vicinity to share an enthusiasm for, and I think the internet can connect you to people like that. But obviously overdoing anything is bad.
Pat, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Alexander, the couple, I think it's a handful. I don't think it's a lot of journalists that are leaving Twitter. But a number of them said, or when they were interviewed, there was some discussion about, you know, instead of being on Twitter, get out of your office, put on your sneaks and go out and do some real gumshoe journalism. Do you see it that way?
Well, I hate to be the person who's like, no, the internet's great, guys. Listen, it's wonderful. But I think some of the really good gumshoe journalism that did happen this past election cycle was David Fahrenthold. And he relied often on Twitter because people are willing to go and do research. He said that like you wouldn't think you'd be able to find answers to these questions until you put them out there on Twitter. And there's a sleuth who's able to go and look it up. So, again, there's many ways of connecting with people and doing gumshoe journalism. And I think each space obviously has its own sort of dynamic. Like Facebook is just a constant panoply of exciting babies and like opinions from your friends, like mothers-in-law, about politics that you didn't know they had and things like that. And Instagram is just delightful flowers and breakfasts and more babies, and Twitter's puns and journalists. But each space is just a place where people go to hang out. And I think it's almost not inherently sort of a non-person place.
Let me play something that...
That sentence was going so well. No.
Let me just play something. Salman Rushdie was on the show a week or so ago, and we discussed a whole bunch of things, including Twitter. Now, Rushdie left Twitter last year. This was immediately after the presidential election. But until then, he had been a pretty enthusiastic person who did Twitter, and let's find out why.
I was told by a friend I should try it because I'd enjoy it. And so I tried it. I did enjoy it. You know, I liked having the direct contact with readers and having fun with people in a kind of lighthearted way. And then I don't know exactly what happened. I think either I changed or it changed. You know, I'm not sure my sense is that Twitter has become more bad-tempered. You know, I mean, that there's a lot more, you know, trolling and kind of like lynch mobbery, you know, and I just thought, I don't like this tone of voice. You know, I don't like and I'd rather be not in this conversation. So I just stopped.
Alexander, I think he didn't like himself when he was on Twitter. Can you relate to that?
I can totally see that. And another part of Twitter that we haven't really discussed is the fact that there's, you know, there's a considerable amount of harassment that goes on sort of on a daily basis. In the time that we've been tweeting here, this is like relatively, you know, chill and of limited impact. But somebody tweeted to me, please, like, stay off the radio. Your voice is driving me to drink. Just in like the few seconds that we've not been on here. So, and that's like nice harassment as far as the internet goes. There's like a serious Nazi problem on Twitter. And so when you're talking about mobs and not liking the way, the sort of groupings that are happening and people that are saying things, I think that is the flip side of being able to create a space where people who are like-minded can come together. You also create this sort of sense that there's all of these people out there who think horrible things and they can find each other.
Well, I love the phrase lynch mobbery that that he just used. I think it's a very apt description. What about hot takes? What do you think of that?
I prefer like a room temperature take. I like to wait until my takes have cooled.
And for the uninitiated, how do you describe what a hot take is?
I think a hot take, it's like the second something's happened, the first thing you think about it. It's like playing improv constantly with the news. You see something and you just say the first thing that comes into your mind. And sometimes that thing is a beautiful, well-reasoned paragraph full of insights, but almost never. Usually it's like a deeply regrettable sentiment. And then you get to watch sort of like the Hegelian dialectic taking place in real time where you have the most extreme take and then the most extreme response to that most extreme take and you sort of oscillate back and forth. It's riveting, but at least on Twitter you get to type it out and see it and have a button you can push before you send it. Whereas if you're on television having to give your hottest take immediately, just whatever's coming out of your mouth, that's the only thing that you're going to say. So
I Googled hot takes and I got ultra hot takes. I got gourmet hot takes. I got first takes and hot takes. I mean, there's a lot of that out there.
Yeah, no, the tastiest takes, I feel like, are sort of have cooled slightly, but sometimes just hot and fresh out of the take kitchen is ideal.
Okay, I wasn't sure where you were going to go. No,
I wasn't sure either. It was a fun discovery process. See, this is the problem with hot takes, because people ask you to say things immediately after something happens, and then you don't know. Are you going to say that hot takes are ideal? Are you going to say that they're bad? It's a split-second decision. I was just illustrating by my response the folly of hot takes as a concept.
There you go. There's the inevitable question that if you gave up Twitter, what would you do with the rest of your life? And I guess I feel compelled to ask you that, Alexander Petri.
I don't know. I think I'd wander off into the desert with my phone over my shoulder, and I'd keep walking until I came to a town where no one recognized what it was. And then I'd settle there, and I'd sow the ground with crops and, I guess, raise a family and not think of Ithaca too much.
And why Ithaca?
Oh, but I was just making an Odyssey joke.
Oh,
on Twitter,
you.
People would have got, there would have been like
See,
the one
I'm
person
slow.
Who got that.
Well, I have
it.
To admit,
no,
I am the most boring person on Twitter there is. I'm just saying.
I don't think that's possible. I'm sure there's someone more boring than you. You're
barely.
Interesting to talk to and already. So there's people who just tweet like the letter R by mistake, and that's all they've ever tweeted. So I think
I'm a little better than that, but not much. Alexander, we're going to say goodbye. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Alexandra Petri from the ISDN studios of the Washington Post, where she is a columnist. And we began earlier in the hour talking about news and propaganda and hoaxes, talking with Alexis Madrigal from The Atlantic and April Glazer from Slate. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, yes, and you can also sign up for our newsletter. Dana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us.